The Undisclosed Addendum is brought to you this week by Squarespace. Build it beautiful at squarespace.com. You can learn all about how Squarespace can help you build a beautiful website during Squarespace's spot later in the addendum. Until then, enjoy the program.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at EvidenceProfBlog. In episode 3, I discussed how, at trial, D'Angelo Montgomery recanted her statement implicating Jamar Huggins in the Memory Lane home invasion. But I also discussed how the judge in the case still denied the defense's motion for a directed verdict based upon an evidence law that only applies in a handful of states. In this addendum, I'll delve deeper into some of the legal issues raised by the episode and answer some of your social media questions. Part 1. Eyewitness Identifications. In episode 3, I played a clip from my interview of Valina Beatty in which she explained the Neal versus Biggers factors a court assesses to determine whether an identification is reliable enough to be admitted at trial, including the amount of attention paid to the perpetrator and the amount of time between the crime and the identification. As she went on to explain, though,
these are all actually poor indicators of the reliability of a witness. They're all self-reporting, and they're based on the individual, not on the actual process of interviewing the eyewitness. They're also not based on empirical evidence, and they're not really related to accuracy.
Moreover, Beatty went on to note that the Supreme Court compounded this issue in its subsequent opinion in Manson v. Brathwaite when it found that an identification that satisfied these reliability factors is admissible and reaches the jury even if the procedure used by the police was unduly suggestive.
Right. So that really comes home in Manson v. Brathwaite, where the court, a couple years later, again in the 1970s, so we're talking over 40 years ago, the court says, we're not actually going to look at the influence by the police or whether this was unnecessarily suggestive. We're going to focus on these factors established in Neal versus Biggers, these Biggers factors, to determine whether the eyewitness was reliable. And the ironic thing is that in Manson versus Brathwaite, they're like, we're really concerned about reliability. And they say, quote, reliability is the linchpin in determining the admissibility of identification testimony. And yet, again, these Biggers factors don't actually get at the heart of reliability. They're all self-reporting by the eyewitness. They're not based on empirical evidence. And again, they're not related to accuracy. And 40 years later, we have hundreds of research projects and papers that have shown exactly how unreliable this admissibility test is. The other unfortunate thing about Manson versus Brathwaite is that the court really put it in the purview of the jury to determine whether an eyewitness was reliable or not. They said, quote, they're content to rely upon the good sense and judgment of American juries, and also, quote, juries are not so susceptible that they cannot measure intelligently the weight of identification testimony that has some questionable feature, end quote. Well, juries aren't given any guidance on how to determine whether an eyewitness is reliable or not. And an eyewitness in the courtroom can present as incredibly credible because the eyewitness believes it, even if that memory itself isn't accurate. So again, the court doesn't get to the crux of the issue with reliability. They say they care about reliability, but they're just not able to address it accurately or effectively in Manson versus Brathwaite.
I followed up on this by asking Professor Beatty about the importance of reforming the way that many jurisdictions currently conduct eyewitness identifications.
Well, we now have hundreds of scientific studies that really identify the malleability of human memory, how much it can change and be influenced. But we also know that eyewitness identification is pivotal for many criminal cases. It's a very compelling evidence in the courtroom and important evidence for police to have for investigating cases. So we have this difficult juxtaposition where we have questionably reliable evidence, but it's so necessary. And the traditional eyewitness identification procedures that police implement and the safeguards that courtrooms have, so the Manson versus Brathwaite test, really fail to make this identification the strongest it can be. Misidentification is the leading contributing cause of wrongful convictions. Real perpetrators have actually been identified in 40% of misidentification DNA cases. And these real perpetrators are responsible for additional violent crimes in 98 of these cases, so in a percentage of these cases. So we have the real perpetrator not being identified, going free while an innocent person is in prison. So the helpful thing about these studies is that we now know how to implement protocols to make the eyewitness identification the strongest it can be. So we can acknowledge that there are challenges with eyewitness identification and that it has led to wrongful convictions, but we can do something to change that. We can affirmatively take steps to make eyewitness identifications more reliable.
Recently, on January 6th, the Department of Justice spearheaded such reforms with now former Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates issuing department-wide procedures on eyewitness identifications that will apply to agents at the FBI, DEA, ATF, and the U.S. Marshals Service. I asked Professor Beatty about a few of the major procedures included in this DOJ memo. The first is what I'll call the double-blind procedure, whereby the officer conducting the lineup, show-up, or photo array is unaware of the identity of the suspect.
Right. So this is about the officer, as you said, not being able to intentionally or unintentionally, consciously or subconsciously influence who the witness chooses. So when they're showing the photos, they're not perhaps delaying on a photo or coming back to a photo again or making a comment when related to a particular person, because the issue here is that the officer is presumed to know who the suspect is. And if the officer knows who the suspect is, then is the officer going to send cues, whether intentionally or not, to the witness that this is the person we think it is? Is this the person you think it is, too? And for small departments, you know, I've talked with police chiefs who are like, we only have three officers in our department. How are we supposed to have a separate officer come in who doesn't know who the suspect is, who doesn't know about the case? We just don't have enough manpower to address this potential influence. And the answer is so simple. It's something called the folder shuffle method, where the officer simply puts each photo from the lineup in a separate manila envelope. So say he has five photos, he puts each in an envelope, you have five of those, and then you have two blank envelopes as well. So you have these manila envelopes, each one has a photo in them, and then you hand them to the witness. And the witness goes through the folders. The officer does not see what photo the witness is looking at. And the witness can look at that photo and say yes or no, and then move on to the next folder. And then you have two blank folders at the end, so the witness doesn't know, oh, this is the last photo. Ah, I should pick this person. So they go through the whole sequence. And that way the officer doesn't know which photo is in which envelope and can't influence the witness.
I next asked Professor Beatty about the second new DOJ policy, which involves explicitly informing the eyewitness that the perpetrator of the crime might not be in the lineup or photo array, and that the investigation will continue regardless of whether the eyewitness makes an identification.
Yeah, the instructions to the witness are crucial. You can go online and do little tests, or there's a 60 Minutes episode where you can do a little test where you watch this video and you see a crime in action and then you see the lineup. And I've done it, and I went through the lineup, and at the end they're like, who is it? And I was like, oh, it's number six. And it wasn't. The person wasn't there. But as a witness, you're presented these photos and you just apparently think, okay, this perpetrator is actually here in this lineup. You don't even think maybe the person isn't there. So this instruction is really important. It deters the eyewitness from feeling compelled to choose someone and from making a relative judgment. This person looks like the individual or looks most like the individual, so I'll pick this person. You really want it to be an identification. And then also with these instructions, you don't have the witness looking for cues from the police administrator about who to pick or whether the selection is correct or not.
At the beginning of this answer, Professor Beatty is referencing the 60 Minutes piece on the case of Ronald Cotton, a North Carolina man who is incorrectly identified by Jennifer Thompson as a rapist. During the piece, psychologist Gary Wells tells reporter Leslie Stahl about an eyewitness identification study.
Wells showed me a study in which more than 300 subjects were shown deliberately shaky videotape of a simulated crime.
You look out a window and you see some suspicious behavior. What happens is we tell them later then, this person that you saw right there put a bomb down that down the air shaft there.
Then subjects are shown a lineup and asked to identify the bomber.
That would be so hard.
Very difficult. I just saw it. And, of course, you're particularly cautious right now. You know now, after we've talked, probably not to pick anyone.
No, actually. I actually know who it is, because if I had come upon that, I think it's this guy. Am I wrong? Mm-hmm. Am I wrong?
Yeah.
I'm wrong?
Yeah.
Okay, so there you go. And I'm already saying how hard it is.
It's none of them.
Isn't that bizarre?
You know about this. We've talked about this. So this is the difficult. This is what makes it so difficult. Look what you just did to me.
Yeah. I'm mortified.
Another aspect of eyewitness identification is discussed in the 60 Minutes piece was the confidence the eyewitness has in her identification. And the new DOJ policy says that immediately following the identification, the witness should be asked to describe in his or her own words how confident he or she is in the identification. I asked Professor Beattie why such a description is so essential.
Well, it's essential because eyewitness confidence is highly malleable. There's a famous study, Good, You Pick the Suspect, where feedback after an identification from an officer can influence the confidence of the eyewitness. So the eyewitness may be, 50% certain that she chose the right person, but if an officer is then like, oh, good, you chose the suspect, then their confidence is heightened. This becomes a problem because by the time they get to trial, their confidence has increased to the point of they're on the stand and they say, I am absolutely certain that that was the perpetrator. So this is why it's important to, at the time of identification, get a confidence statement. How certain are they at that moment? So this is before that confidence is changed by any circumstances in the cases. And it can provide information on the accuracy of the identification.
This gets us to a Twitter question, which comes from Katie Long. Her Twitter handle is @KatieKennig, and she asks, Neil versus Biggers, considering an eyewitness's certainty in evidence, many studies show that's not correlated with accuracy. And the answer to that is, it's true, a witness's stated certainty in their identification isn't that correlated with accuracy. But now I'm going to quote from an article. It is Suggestive Eyewitness Identification Procedures and the Supreme Court's Reliability Test in Light of Eyewitness Science 30 Years Later. It's an article in Law and Human Behavior in 2009, and the authors reviewed several experiments done on eyewitness identifications, and their conclusion based upon all these studies is that, quote, psychological scientists have generally concluded that eyewitness certainty, although of limited utility, can have some diagnostic value. So to answer Keita's question, eyewitness certainty isn't the greatest thing in the world, but it does have some relevance in terms of the accuracy of an identification. Now, moving back to my interview with Professor Beattie, one thing the DOJ did not answer is whether agents should use simultaneous lineups where witnesses are shown six people or six photos all at the same time, or sequential lineups where witnesses are shown only one person or one photo at a time. I asked Professor Beattie about this decision.
The sequential is supposed to be an opportunity for the witness to compare the individual photo directly with her memory. So she's not making a relative choice and saying, I'm looking at all six of these photos at one time, which one looks most like the perpetrator? Instead, it's a direct comparison, direct recall. Is this the individual? How does this match with my memory? So that lends to its reliability. There was a field study published by the American Judicature Society, four studies where they were able to find that there are significantly few filler identifications, so identifying a filler rather than the suspect, and that it was a more rigorous memory test doing the sequential. That said, I think the other really important guidelines are going to be the most effective in strengthening eyewitness identifications. I support going with sequential lineups. I think the studies show that that would make an eyewitness identification even more reliable.
Finally, I ended the interview by asking Professor Beattie about the most important eyewitness identification case that she's handled as the head of the West Virginia Innocence Project.
One case we had that prompted our legislature to adopt an eyewitness identification bill and establish police protocols and really brought law enforcement on board for establishing these police protocols statewide was there was a shooting in Charleston, West Virginia. An individual was arrested, and there were three eyewitnesses. And within days, because of really good police work, the police were able to determine that the eyewitnesses had misidentified the individual, and they released him. And fortunately, the case was fresh enough that they had been able to find the true perpetrator. And that's an example of the need for accurate identifications and how that's so pivotal to accurate police work and to police being able to do their job. And fortunately, in that case, it didn't get to the point of someone being wrongfully convicted, but it really brought our communities together behind establishing some standards and protocols for eyewitness identifications with law enforcement.
Make your next move with a beautiful website from Squarespace. With Squarespace, you can create a great website or online store with an award-winning template. Squarespace award-winning templates are the most beautiful way to present your ideas online. You can create your website with Squarespace's all-in-one platform. There's nothing to install, patch, or upgrade ever. And Squarespace provides award-winning 24/7 customer support. They also offer a unique domain experience that's fully transparent and simple to set up. Squarespace is used by a wide range of creatives, people, and businesses, including musicians, designers, artists, restaurants, and many more. And now, undisclosed listeners, you can visit www.squarespace.com and use the promo code undisclosed for 10% off any website subscription or domain purchase. That's www.squarespace.com and use the promo code undisclosed. Squarespace, make your next move. Part 2, Reasonable Doubt. Here are two social media questions. The first comes from Cat Waterflame. Her Twitter handle is @CatWaterflame. And she asks, I'm still so confused as to how Jamar got convicted. Who had it out for Jamar? There's no way he should be in jail. And the second question comes from Nicola Houlihan. And she asks, how the hell did a jury find Jamar guilty? Scary, poor guy. Now, in episode 3, I told you about Paul George, the Pennsylvania attorney who was applying for cert to the U.S. Supreme Court in the case of Michael Rudd, who, like Jamar, was convicted based solely on the unsworn prior inconsistent statement of a witness who later recanted at trial. Now, George's argument was that only a handful of states allow for a conviction on such shaky evidence, and that such evidence is constitutionally insufficient to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. But unfortunately, the Supreme Court didn't take the bait. On Tuesday, it was announced that the Supreme Court denied cert, so they won't hear the Rudd appeal. That said, George had some interesting comments beyond what I aired in episode 3, and I'll include a few of them here. The first thing he noted is that, in some ways, the prosecution might actually prefer a witness who recants at trial.
Because then the district attorney gets called the detective who took the statement from them, and that person is a far more experienced witness and far more credible than the actual accuser. That person gets on the witness stand and statement, which sounds, you know, perfectly candid and true coming from them. And even though you can get the detective to say, I have no knowledge as to whether this statement is true or not, that detective inevitably seems like a more credible witness than the actual accuser. And there's never an opportunity for the jury to see the accuser when the accuser is actually the accusation, to assess credibility and demeanor, the most critical point. And in the absence of that, it seems to me that, you know, it should be sufficient evidence as a matter of law. It shouldn't be sent to the jury at that point.
Following up on this, George also noted how a witness recanting at trial can sometimes actually be a disadvantage to the defense and lead to the creation of a burden that's nearly impossible to satisfy.
Here's another thing that happens at these trials, and I think I wrote this in one of my briefs, that they actually devolve into mini perjury trials where the prosecution's way of proceeding is essentially to put their own witnesses on trial for perjury. They feel like if they can prove that this person is lying now on the witness stand, that that means that they were telling the truth before when they were given their out-of-court statement. And, you know, I'm afraid that the jury expects the defense attorney to sort of act as defense counsel for the recanting witness, that it becomes the defense attorney's job to prove that their in-court test is true, that they, in fact, don't really know who did it, that they only made the accusation to get out of trouble, you know, with the cops about some other, you know, crime that they had committed, et cetera, et cetera. That you're kind of thrust in the position as the defense attorney to, you know, vouch for the credibility of their present testimony. When in fact, what your position is that, look, you see what this guy's just a liar. Everyone can tell he's a liar. The question is, when, if ever, was he the truth? And once you've agreed, once there's universal agreement that this is a person who will lie about something this important, this case shouldn't go to the jury, and it certainly hasn't. You certainly haven't been presented with proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
This leads into another Twitter question, this one by Nora D. Her Twitter handle is @NoraNsDevlin, and she asks, what other states have these rogue and crazy evidence laws in place? Now, actually, on my blog, Evidence Prof Blog, I did a 50-state survey. And while it's not 100% clear, the list of states that have similar evidence rules is sort of like an undisclosed greatest hit. So it's in addition to South Carolina, Maryland, Georgia, Pennsylvania. There might be one or two others, but those are the clear states where it seems that based solely upon an unsworn prior inconsistent statement that's recanted at trial, we can have a conviction of defendants. In 2017, the University of South Carolina School of Law celebrates 150 years of contributing to the common good through a hands-on approach to legal education, leading to a cutting-edge understanding and application of the law. The School of Law will also move to its new state-of-the-art home this summer, built with the needs of today's students in mind. We've made National Jurist Magazine's Best Value Law School for 8 years in a row, and were named a top 50 go-to law school by the National Law Journal in 2016. If Undisclosed has inspired your interest to study the law, we encourage you to start your journey toward a legal career by visiting the University of South Carolina School of Law at law.sc.edu. Part 3, Amending Indictments. In order to be able to charge a defendant with a crime, the prosecutor needs to have probable cause to believe that the defendant violated a criminal statute. In this context, probable cause is defined as, quote, a state of facts as would lead a person of ordinary caution or prudence to believe and conscientiously entertain a strong suspicion of the fact to be proved. In other words, a prosecutor can charge a defendant if the evidence would make a reasonable person have a strong suspicion the defendant committed a crime. Now, the primary way that a prosecutor's claim of probable cause is tested is through use of grand jurors. A grand jury is like a trial jury drawn from the community where the crime was committed, except a grand jury is simply determining whether there's probable cause for the case to proceed to trial, not whether there's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Moreover, the grand jury only hears the prosecution side of the case, and the prosecutor is under no obligation to present exculpatory evidence. If a majority of the grand jurors find probable cause, they issue what's known as a true bill, which allows the prosecutor to indict the defendant and take the case to trial. It's pretty well recognized that grand juries almost always indict, with one notable exception.
These decisions are also controversial because grand juries usually choose to indict. Reports have said that 99% of all cases that go before a federal grand jury end with the prosecution taking the case to criminal trial, and so do the majority of state grand juries. There's a famous quote from a former chief judge of New York that grand juries will indict a ham sandwich if the prosecution wants them to. However, the statistics also show that grand juries rarely indict a police officer. An investigation by the Houston Chronicle found that police have been nearly immune from criminal charges in shootings in large cities. For example, grand juries in Dallas, Texas reviewed 81 officer-related shootings between 2008 and 2012 and indicted only one person.
That 99% indictment rate applies to federal grand juries, and there are some states that have indictment percentages that are lower. But South Carolina is pretty much in conformity with the federal percentage. A 2015 study found that grand juries in Greenville County in South Carolina have returned indictments in 99.9% of cases since 2011, while grand juries in Charleston County returned indictments in all but 7 out of the 6,366 cases that they heard. But while a grand jury indictment is thus a low hurdle, it's a hurdle the prosecution needs to jump over, and both federal and South Carolina law provide that a prosecutor can amend an indictment at trial. And what that means is that if we were looking at the Jamar Huggins case between 2001 and 2005, his burglary conviction would pretty quickly and pretty easily be thrown out. In 2001, the Supreme Court of South Carolina decided a case by the name of State v. Lynch. Like the Jamar Huggins case, the Lynch case involved a first-degree burglary trial. The prosecutor charged James Lynch with first-degree burglary based upon the aggravating circumstance of the burglary occurring in the nighttime. This was the charge that was taken to the grand jury, which returned an indictment. At the start of trial, though, the prosecutor realized that there was a question over whether the burglary actually occurred at night, and he moved to amend the indictment so the jury could find Lynch guilty of first-degree burglary on the alternate theory that the burglary caused physical injury to the homeowner. Lynch was eventually convicted, but he later successfully appealed. According to the court, quote, "We find that by changing the aggravating circumstance from entering during the darkness to causing physical injury, the amendment to the indictment substituted an entirely different offense for the one charged. And as a result, Lynch's conviction was not only erroneous, in fact, it actually meant the trial court didn't even have subject matter jurisdiction or authority to hear the case. Therefore, the argument could have been raised at any point, even after Lynch had exhausted his appeals and his conviction would have been thrown out." But then, in 2005 and 2006, in State v. Gentry and State v. Means, South Carolina's highest court tweaked this analysis. Both of those cases also involved amendment of first-degree burglary indictments to add aggravating circumstances, and in both cases, the court found the change to be erroneous. But the court now concluded that the error only went to the issue of notice received by the defendant and not the jurisdiction of the court. In other words, amendment of an indictment is still error, but it's an error that needs to be raised in direct appeal or else it's waived. So what does this all have to do with the Jamar Huggins case? The indictment in Jamar's case alleged that Jamar committed a burglary that became a first-degree burglary based upon the aggravating circumstances of possession of a deadly weapon and injury caused to the homeowner. On the first day of trial, however, prosecutor Donna Elder moved to amend the indictment to include an additional aggravating circumstance that the burglary occurred in the nighttime. Defense counsel, of course, objected, and Judge Culberson responded by asking defense counsel whether prior knowledge of this amendment would have changed his trial preparation. When defense counsel responded that it would not have changed his trial prep, Judge Culberson allowed the amendment, concluding that, quote, "it doesn't really affect the trial preparation in any regard." But that's wrong. In the Means case I mentioned a minute ago, the Supreme Court of South Carolina confirmed that, quote, "the appropriate analysis is whether the amendment to the indictment changed the nature of the offense charged, not whether the amendment in any way surprised or prejudiced the defendant. Therefore, the prosecutor in Jamar's case should not have been allowed to amend the indictment, and this would have been a winning issue on direct appeal. But as you'll see in episode 4, this issue wasn't raised in direct appeal, and because it's no longer a jurisdictional issue, it can't be raised now to free Jamar. Part 4, social media questions. This first question comes from Kathy Jesdemer. Her Twitter handle is @MCJesdemer, and she asks, why was there no search on Jamar's property? Did they think they wouldn't find anything? It's a great question, and I obviously can't get into the head of the detective in this case, and in fact, I reached out to Detective Martin, but he understandably said that the policy was that he couldn't comment in this case. But here's the way the prosecution and the defense framed the argument in their closing arguments. First, here's Prosecutor Donna Elder. Mr. Long indicated in his opening that once they got Jamar Huggins, that was it. This officer was done. This detective is done. That's all he cared about. Making the arrest, that's it. He never interviewed anybody else. Who else is there to interview? How many people were involved that night? He interviewed Ms. Eckler. He interviewed D'Angela, told you he interviewed Jamar, and he told you after Jamar, he went and interviewed somebody named T. How many people is that? The victim and 1, 2, 3, 4 people. Now again, if he was the kind of officer that just wanted to close a case by arrest, why didn't he rush out and get warrants against all of them? He didn't. He got warrants against 2 people. two of the three because although he may have had suspicions about the third individual and who that may have been, that it was, may have been T, he didn't feel that he had enough evidence against that person because nobody described him, nobody pointed him out, wasn't his car. So he did the right thing. He didn't rush to arrest anybody. He arrested the two people that his investigation led to. That is responsible police work. Now, of course, defense counsel John Long had a very different take on things in his closing argument. Here's what he argued. I asked Detective Martin, I said, let's talk about what you did not do. He did not get a search warrant for anyone's house. He did not get a search warrant for anyone's car. He knew that there was a gun involved, a mask involved, gloves involved. He didn't look for any of that stuff. They got DNA swabs, but he never followed up. He said he never got results from the SLED lab. This is a CSI world, just like you see on TV. There is technology out there that if somebody is guilty of a crime, they can catch that guy. We got no hard evidence. There's no exhibits. Oftentimes in a trial, you've got exhibits stacked up here, one after another. In this case, you've got words. You've got words of a woman who admitted she lied, but then she under testimony said, that man right there, Jamar Huggins, didn't do it. He wasn't involved in the crime. They never arrested the second person. They say two men went in there, but they only arrested one person and they arrested the wrong guy. They stopped their investigation. They closed the case. This second question comes from Sydney Cheek. Her Twitter handle is @SydneyCheek and she asks, how does police deception of suspects in the U.S. compare to other countries' practices? Now, I don't have an exhaustive list, but it seems as if many Western European countries have a lower tolerance for police deception. In England, for instance, after a spate of several high-profile wrongful convictions based upon false confessions, the Police and Criminal Evidence Act, or PACE, was passed in 1984. While it doesn't completely outlaw all police deception, PACE does greatly curtail the practice. And in Germany, as another example, evidence obtained through the use of police, brutality, or deceit must be excluded without any balancing of the interests involved.
You don't know my mind, doggone it.
Thanks for listening to this week's Undisclosed Addendum. If you want to contribute to Justice for Jamar, you can donate to his legal defense fund at www.fundedjustice.com/JamarHuggins. I'd like to thank the following people. Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the host of the Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories podcast for audio production. Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Christy Williams and Nina Musser for website management. Baluki for our logo. And Mital Telhan, our executive producer. This season's addendum theme was written by Ramiro Marquez, performed by Mark Augustin, and produced by Patrick Cortez. Some of the music you heard throughout this episode comes from Ward Dunn and his South Carolina band, Pluto Wilson. You can get their music at plutowilson.bandcamp.com. The credit song is South Carolina bluesman Pink Anderson's public domain version of You Don't Know My Mind. Finally, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @UndisclosedPod, and you can send me questions for future addenda by using the hashtag UDAddendum.